Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. As the turmoil continued in Venezuela this week, I reached out to several professors at the University of New Mexico to help us gain some context and understanding of the crisis. Jose Luis Palacios is originally from Venezuela and is a lecturer in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UNM. He's also the former provost of Universidad Simón Bolívar in Caracas. Professor William Stanley is a political scientist who directs the Latin American and Iberian Institute at UNM. His research includes how international influences shape domestic politics and institutions. Both of them participated recently in a campus teach-in on Venezuela. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you for having us.
We're taping this on March 12th. The United States is withdrawing its remaining diplomatic staff from the country. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo noted their presence has become a, quote, constraint on U.S. policy. There's an ongoing power outage in the country that's been going on for 5 days. It has crippled hospitals, gas stations, even water sources. The Maduro government blames sabotage by the United States. U.S. officials blame Russia and Cuba. The opposition blames years of incompetence in maintaining the power grid. This comes after months of dwindling food supplies and medicine and hyperinflation. Professor Stanley, Venezuela used to be flush with oil money. It was pretty stable. How did we get to this crisis point?
Well, really, there are two big factors. I see the beginnings of this back in 2001, 2002. The Chavez administration took control of PDVSA, which is the petroleum company of Venezuela, and began to divert funds from that company to support social programs. That happened to take place also during a period, an upswing in petroleum prices, so that there was a lot of money to work with for that project. So you get a period of growth in the early 2000s, followed by around 2014, the petroleum prices started to drop. At the same time, PDVSA's production has been gradually falling because the company went from being, you know, a very well-run company to one that was disinvesting, where basically new equipment wasn't being installed, and production declined gradually over time. Now, with falling prices, there's a lot less funds to work with. The Maduro administration has continued the social spending, big expansion of the public sector, et cetera, without the money needed to do that, doing it initially by borrowing, and then as Venezuela's ability to borrow collapsed, by printing money. So the central bank has been emitting bolivares at huge numbers, to the point that now the inflation rate is approaching 1,000,000% per annum, and you know, the currency essentially has no value. Dealing with that inflation, the government imposed price controls and exchange rate controls that basically forced companies that had food and medicines, et cetera, to sell them at a lower price in dollars than it would cost to replace them. And so the importation of all kinds of products has collapsed, leading to the shortages.
Professor Palacios, you left Venezuela in 2013?
That's correct.
What finally made you decide to leave?
The presidential election, when Maduro supposedly won, and he beat by tenths of a percentage the opposition candidate, we said that is the last straw. And so we left. And
you felt that it wasn't a fair election and things did not bode well.
No, not at all. Not at all. We have a election council, which is packed with Chavistas. And this is supposed to be...
These are people who supported Hugo Chavez.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. In a proportion of 4-1. There were 5 members, 4 of which were declared Chavistas. And so the election is supposed to be conducted under very strict rules and electronic machines. So you have like a touch screen type thing, and then you have a receipt, and then you take this receipt and you put it in a box. So it seems like this is like the perfect type of election, except that, the company that built the machines, Smartmatic, declare after the 2017 election that there were like at least 1,000,000 votes that they didn't know where they came from. That is manipulation of the mechanisms.
Did that happen as well in the 2013 election?
It is open to debate how clean any of the elections were under Hugo Chavez and under Maduro.
Okay.
God only knows.
Okay.
And in addition to that, you have population that is taken from their dwellings in buses. And if your life depends on how you vote, it is not too difficult to imagine what happens inside the voting booth. And then when you deposit that visible ticket with your choice. So once you get back home, then you have the leaders of the neighborhood who will say, well, this one will get the canister of gas for cooking. This will not, because he didn't vote for whoever it was that, you know, he had to vote for.
Professor Stanley, is that how elections were run previously, before Chavez?
It was a sort of pacted electoral system from 1958 onward under what was called the Punto Fijo agreement between two major parties that exchanged power periodically, and they kind of had an agreement in place that there wouldn't be big changes in policy regardless of who was in power. And that broke down in the early 90s in the context of a need for neoliberal policies to sort of stabilize the economy. And so that led to the, you know, popular demands for a more egalitarian economic system that led to the election of Chavez. My view is that initially Chavez's initial election and his re-election were probably indicative of popular sentiment at the time. There may have been some procedural irregularities, but I'm pretty confident that represented the will of the people at the time that he was elected. Since then, I think it's declined sharply. The popular support for the regime has declined sharply. I do not believe the election of Maduro last May reflected popular consent.
An analysis by the BBC found that during Chavez's tenure, literacy rates did increase. Many were lifted out of poverty by higher wages, and there was better health care. Why has this fallen apart?
Well, in my view, the investments in improving social conditions for the poor in the early to mid-2000s did have very positive effects. But they were based upon an upswing in oil prices. That policy happened to coincide with an upswing in prices that made it financially possible. It was done in a short-sighted way, and Venezuela didn't keep sufficient reserves to be able to continue with those policies. The other thing that happened was that there were many informal arrangements set up by the government at the community level to distribute goods and to control the population in a variety of ways. And as the government ran into financial problems, those organizations became increasingly important and repressive at local levels. So that I think you're seeing now a move away from support for the government by a lot of the people who were initially supportive of it.
Well, what William says is totally correct, but I have to underline the fact that as Chavez was implementing these social programs, at the same time, he was destroying all the institutions, in particular, the universities.
In what way?
In the sense that why did he have to hire so-called doctors from Cuba to attend the population when we have excellent medical schools where students and graduates who can do these very things while at the same time destroying all the institutions.
You mean by not funding them? Or
right.
Not,
mm-hmm. But I would like to also take the opportunity to urge everybody to ask for the immediate release of Luis Carlos Diaz, a journalist that was apprehended last night.
He was apprehended on March 11th.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is what happens when you try to tell the truth these days.
This is 89.9 KUNM, and this is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm speaking with Jose Luis Palacios. He's originally from Venezuela and is a lecturer in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UNM. He's also former provost of Universidad Simón Bolívar in Caracas. Also joining me is Professor William Stanley, who directs the Latin American and Iberian Institute at UNM. We taped this on March 12th. You just heard Palacios mention the arrest of journalist Luis Carlos Diaz. That did prompt an outcry, and Diaz has since been released. Well, it seems pretty clear that the U.S. government is pushing regime change in Venezuela. What do you think about this possibility?
In my opinion, what's going on right now in Venezuela is not short of a genocide. Might be a low-motion genocide, but it is. If you read the Statute of Rome, Articles 6 and 7 on genocide.
These are international statutes, international
yes,
law.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, the U.S. is not a signatory of this agreement. But people have lost, on average, like 40 pounds. So 70% of the population has lost 40 pounds of weight in the last few years. It is estimated that 3.5 to 4 million Venezuelans have left the country. Mm-hmm. That is the extent of the exile of Venezuelans. And so if we have those things, if we have no water, no electricity, no gas, hospitals are unequipped, people are dying of hunger, malnutrition. So there is a humanitarian crisis. You cannot hide that with all the rhetoric of Maduro on the TV.
There's no denying there's a humanitarian crisis, but what I've seen in the news is that even people who oppose the regime, some of them, are less sanguine about the idea of some kind of military intervention by the United States.
Yeah, my sense is that U.S. intervention at this time would be counterproductive. And there's clearly no support for that among the neighboring countries. This is, at the end of the day, a conflict among Venezuelans about different visions of how the country should be governed. Although I think the Maduro regime does need to step aside for the welfare of the country. The U.S. role is probably counterproductive in the sense that it feeds into the rhetoric of the regime that everything that's wrong is the fault of the United States. Mm. There's a tendency among people who support the regime to blame all of the economic hardships right now, for example, on the United States and United States sanctions. My view is that the U.S. sanctions that have been imposed recently are, in fact, greatly reducing oil exports and earnings for the country. But the things we did earlier didn't have a lot of teeth. And so I think, you know, the real hardships that are being experienced now are largely the result of bad policy by the government. And in some sense, I think the government needs to be held accountable for that by its own public.
Although if they can't get money from oil exports, this is pretty much ensuring the death of the regime. That does sound like a pretty harsh sanction.
Right. But I think when a country has caused the flight of something on the order of 4 million people into neighboring countries, it does become a threat to international peace and security. And in other instances, in civil war cases, for example, when there are mass migrations, as well as exporting of violence in various forms, the international community often responds with, you know, Chapter 7 peacekeeping operations and that sort of thing. This is not a civil war, so it doesn't fall in that category. But it's definitely a situation that's causing harm to neighboring countries. And so it's not inappropriate at this point for the U.S. to impose sanctions. I wish we would stop with that, the saber rattling that we're seeing by some members of the administration, in particular Senator Rubio with his Twitter campaign, I think is probably counterproductive.
I would tend to disagree with William here. I will insist on the fact that what we have is a civil war, is a genocide. But in this case, we don't see two sides with the machetes. We only see one side with the weapons, and the other side is the one contributing to deaths. I would welcome a military intervention.
You would?
I would. At this point in time, and let me read, this is the article.
You're reading it. You have a little tiny version of the Venezuelan Constitution.
That is correct. And, okay. And that article, 187, numeral 11, says that one of the things that the National Assembly, led by Juan Guaido, can do is authorize the mission, a foreign military mission in the country, in Venezuela. Mm.
Well, I did want to bring up, since you brought up the opposition, the New York Times had a really interesting article this past weekend that reported the burning of an aid convoy that was widely reported to be done by Maduro's government was in fact burned by people opposing his government. What do we need to be doing right now to make sure we're getting reliable information?
Well, I do think that a certain amount of patience is required in interpreting news that comes out. You know, one of the things in the news that struck me was there was a group of about 200 former National Guardsmen from Venezuela who had been living in Colombia, who had rearmed and who were prepared to sort of militarily assist the insertion of one of the humanitarian columns into Venezuela. and the Colombian government restrained them out of fear that that could lead to direct armed conflict and a further escalation of the violence. I agree with Jose that the violence that's taking place is very one-sided, and there's been a tremendous amount of repression, a lot of killing and torturing in jail. There have been some instances of demonstrations being fired upon. And there's been a lot of violence practiced by the so-called colectivos, that are these sort of paramilitary forces that were heavily armed beginning in 2002 and that have become an important bastion of support for the regime. That said, there is a puzzling constraint and restraint on the part of the armed forces. I mean, we know the armed forces leadership is loyal to Maduro. They are closely policed by a sort of Cuban intelligence apparatus that's been installed in the country. So it's very difficult for officers to actually defect from the regime. On the other hand, Guaido is moving around the country with relative freedom.
Juan Guaido, who's declared himself interim president.
Well, he was declared that by the National Assembly, which has the authority to do that. And in fact, the National Assembly—
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, the National Assembly is really the only body that was elected under reasonably legitimate circumstances. And so there's a reason that something like 50 countries have recognized his presidency, because there's a strong legal claim for that. My point is that massive demonstrations have taken place. There's a lot of political activity going on. And to some extent, the military is standing back. And to me, that leads me to believe that they're starting to see the end of the regime. And moreover, given that their ideology is a pro-popular ideology, the ideology of Chavismo is, you know, defense of the interests of the people against imperialist forces and other kinds of injustice, that's not a military that should be engaged in mass repression against its own population. And I think that contradiction is an important constraint.
Hmm. I would like to go back to the power outage. Mm-hmm. This is nothing new. The fact that it has been countrywide and for 4 or 5 days, that is new.
Yes.
But I've lived through those power outages many times in Caracas, and that is the place that they try to keep alight. If you go to the interior of the country, then this happens every day, every other day, and for years and years. And Chavez in 2010 promised that this would be fixed, and it was the beginning of swindling, corruption. They brought junk generators. They brought all sorts of bad equipment to staunch the lack of power, and it never worked.
This seems like it could be a tipping point.
It's hard to really know how this can play out at this point. I think there would have to be some sort of negotiated process because, you know, Maduro and his immediate family could leave the country if were he to step down. It's not possible for the entire Chavista leadership to leave the country. So there's going to have to be some kind of negotiation and probably some sort of kind of unpalatable pact that would protect those individuals, at least to some extent, from prosecution for all the stuff that's gone on. And I think one of the things that we haven't talked about yet is the incredible extent of criminality that has taken root in Venezuela. And this is a deliberate policy of state to delegate power to the military to engage in drug trafficking on a really industrial scale, as well as illegal mining operations and other things. It's a sort of a payoff to the military. It's a perk that they enjoy as long as the regime is in power. And it has caused increases in criminality in other countries. There are very close connections, for example, between the crime wave in Honduras and Venezuelan drug trafficking operations. We're seeing effects of the Honduras violence on our own borders. Venezuela has the highest violence rates of any country in the world right now.
In current news, former Vice President and Minister Tarek El Aissami was charged in the Southern District of New York with violation of the Foreign Narcotics Kingpin Design Designation Act. And there's two nephews of the First Lady who are currently incarcerated in the United States for drug trafficking. So that is a definite source of income for the current regime.
Is this one reason you support U.S. military intervention, Jose?
I'm not saying specifically U.S. military intervention.
Okay.
It could be a multinational action. But the thing is that the international treaties, the Organization of American States, they all give leeway for intervention in this country where things are going the way things are going in Venezuela.
Is it problematic in that context? The U.S. moves right now. They've selected Elliot Abrams to head this effort, who does not have necessarily a reputation for fostering democracy in Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was an unfortunate choice because he carries a lot of baggage as one of the most extreme Cold Warriors, an individual who's been willing to lie very blatantly in support of U.S. policy and to be involved in covert actions, supporting covert actions that were illegal and counterproductive. And so I view that as a choice that was likely intended to intimidate. There's a sense that Venezuela might be a trial run for promoting regime change elsewhere.
That worked so well in the Middle East.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I think back historically to cases where the U.S. has promoted regime change in Central America and the Caribbean or tried to. I get the feeling there's some idea that a 1954 Guatemala-type strategy might work here, which is sort of intimidating the military to the point that they betray their president. I would only point out that, you know, that worked in Guatemala in 54 when we tried exactly the same thing in Cuba in 1960. It failed. And the Venezuelan military now more closely resembles the Cuban military of 1960 than the Guatemalan military of 1954. It's much more organized politically. It's much more resistant to that sort of intimidation.
When people are like, they're not very much in favor of an intervention of the United States, they seem to fail to see that Venezuela is intervened right now by Cuba and Russia and to another extent China. They're supplying them with weapons. And in the case of Cuba, is a total occupation of the armed forces and intelligence and even in civil life. So why are not people throwing their arms up in the air about this sort of intervention?
This is University Showcase on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're discussing Venezuela with Jose Luis Palacios. He's originally from Venezuela and is a lecturer in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UNM. He's also former provost of Universidad Simón Bolívar in Caracas. Also joining me is Professor William Stanley, a political scientist who directs the Latin American and Iberian Institute at UNM. Stanley says the majority of countries in Latin America signaled their support for opposition leader Juan Guaido, except Mexico, which remains neutral.
I mean, I think one of the difficulties for any kind of multilateral solution right now is that the two mechanisms that are available, the OAS and the UN, are both problematic. The OAS because it's viewed as U.S. dominated, so it would not be seen as a fair broker from the point of view of the regime, of Maduro's regime. And the UN, for any sort of action, significant mediation or, say, verification role, would require Security Council action, which would likely be vetoed by Russia and China, which have aligned themselves with Maduro. It's almost like an echo of the Cold War in which the UN is hamstrung by the likelihood of a great power veto.
Recently, Juan Guaido called on his supporters to return. As you mentioned, like about 10% of the population, at least, has fled into exile, and for the military to take a stand.
I don't think either of those things are likely to happen. For one thing, there's just no way people can find food if they return. I do think that the regime is probably in its final months. The sanctions are taking effect, reducing exports, reducing income to the government. Venezuelan crude oil production depends on a lot of outside inputs because the oil is so heavy and thick that it has to be diluted with lighter hydrocarbons in order to run it through pipelines. Their production depends on their ability to import, which depends on their ability to purchase and pay, all of which is collapsing. And so I think the petroeconomy is grinding to a halt, and with the extreme shortages that the country is facing, I think at some point the population's the scope of protest will be so great and the population's loss of fear in the face of repression will be so great that the regime will have to go. What comes next is the question, and I think that's where a multilateral role might be helpful and it might even be possible because once the regime steps aside, then perhaps there's no point on the part of Russia, for example, to veto some sort of Chapter 6 mutually agreeable kind of arrangement where international election observers and monitors of various kinds, human rights monitors, could go into the country and help to stabilize things, as has been frequently done after civil wars. I mean, I think even though it's an atypical situation because it's one-sided, there is no insurgency. But the scope of conflict, the scope of polarization, the destruction of institutions, the need to rebuild public trust in institutions and have institutions that are worthy of trust, all those things are very similar to a post-war situation. And I think many of the practices that have been used to rebuild societies after civil wars and sort of help monitor the reconstruction of institutions will be necessary in this situation.
I don't think that the 4 million Venezuelans scattered in the world are going to go back immediately, not at all. And what was the other question? Guaido calling on the military to turn sides, that is very difficult at this point in time because, like I said, the military are taken over by the Cubans.
It might seem like Venezuela is very far away and we have a ton of domestic issues here. So why is it important for us to pay attention to those?
What's going on in Venezuela is affecting a number of countries in the region, both because of the outflow of refugees, and I think that's the right word for them, refugees from Venezuela, as well as the exporting of violence. And, I mean, I mentioned the effects on Honduras, where criminal connections to Venezuela, it's become a preferred route for drugs being exported out of Venezuela to be landed and then shipped to the United States, which is producing a variety of organized crime developments in Honduras that has spawned increased violence there. We know that Honduras, from being a relatively quiet country, has become the number one immigrant sending country from Central America. That's what's driving the arrival, in part, the arrival of Central American immigrants to our borders. We're also looking at a number of countries in the region that are fairly solid democracies that are being placed under stress by the outflow of Venezuelans.
Yeah, we forget that Caracas is closer to New York City than San Francisco. It's a five-hour flight. If you go to Miami, it's only 3.5 hours. What happens in Venezuela affects the immediate neighbors, Colombia, Brazil. And so these democracies can also be destabilized by this influx of millions of people searching for jobs, searching for better opportunities. And no doubt about it, there might be also some bad apples in there. And so what happens in Venezuela affects directly the U.S. through, you know, the drug trafficking. Many of the times that drugs are caught in Europe, they have been maybe manufactured in Colombia, but they have been channeled through Venezuela.
There's another aspect to the sort of what's at stake, and that is kind of geostrategic one. Basically, mm-hmm. the weakness of the Maduro regime in its crisis has created a tremendous opportunity for Russia to expand its influence, and particularly, you know, financial influence. I mean, they were able to buy a significant portion of Citgo, which is a refining and marketing firm that operates in the United States, for far below its value simply because the Maduro regime was so desperate for funds. And so there's this enhanced presence of anti-democratic foreign powers in the Americas as a result of this crisis.
It's like we never got past the Cold War.
It's a little reminder of the Cold War.
In the end, I would use an argument by The Economist. The Economist put it very bluntly. When it comes down to a country that is being destroyed by its leaders, where the population is suffering and the society is spiraling down into chaos, it is no longer an internal affair. It is everybody's business. The United States, everybody's.
That was Jose Luis Palacios, lecturer in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UNM and former provost of Universidad Simón Bolívar in Caracas, and Professor William Stanley, a political scientist and director of the Latin American and Iberian Institute at UNM. You can find this interview at KUNM.org, along with links to numerous articles about Venezuela. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.